budget, but is there some budging? Hello and welcome to the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. We'll discuss the week that was and dig behind the news and newsmakers making those headlines. Governor Scott met with federal health care officials this week, hoping to get them to cough up cash for low-income health care. That's among the sticking points between legislators who still have not agreed on a state budget, but lawmakers have agreed at least to meet again. Also, the FBI looks into a Palm Beach County police shooting. A media investigation found dozens of fatal shootings by the department have been ruled justified. And who qualifies as Cuban under America's immigration law? Also, the federal government okays ferry service to Cuba. It's all ahead on the Florida Roundup next here on WLRN. Welcome into the Florida Roundup on WLRN. I'm Tom Hudson. Thanks for listening. June in Tallahassee. It's hot. It's humid. And it will be tense this year. Florida lawmakers will go back to work on June 1st with one thing on their mind, pass a state budget. Republicans have not been able to agree on a spending plan yet. The Florida House does not want to expand Medicaid. The Florida Senate has a modified expansion plan. And the two have not struck a deal over money to reimburse hospitals for providing charity health care to low-income Floridians. The difference? $4 billion between the two houses of the state legislature. Governor Rick Scott went to Washington this week and met with the Health and Human Services Secretary, hoping to come away with what the feds will send to Florida for the low-income pool of money. He did not get what he wanted.
And we'll work to try to work with HHS to have a plan that works for them. It is a little disappointing because we've been meeting with them for a long time. And for them not to just now be saying that what we're proposing doesn't make sense, it's a little disappointing.
This meeting between Governor Scott and Health and Human Services Secretary Sylvia Burwell was also a meeting between defendant and plaintiff. You see, Governor Scott is suing Secretary Burwell and her agency, claiming they are trying to strong-arm Florida to expand Medicaid. It was just a year ago when Scott voiced support for the expansion, but he switched positions this spring to oppose it.
And I said, I'm not going to stand in the way of the federal government if they want to take care of patients in our state. But I'm not willing to put our taxpayers on the hook for something where the federal government won't allow us to run a program the way we'd like to run it, a program that we know is causing health care costs to go up, a program that's doing nothing to reduce the cost of health care, and a program that is continuing to have more and more problems.
So will lawmakers be able to agree on health care funding and get the state budget in order in time? What happens if July 1st comes and goes and there's no plan? Are you worried about your state job? How about any state agencies that you rely on? Let us know here on the Florida Roundup at 800-743-WLRN. The telephone number again, 800-743-9576. You can send us a tweet at WLRN. Look for us on Facebook as well. Our guest joining us from Tallahassee is Mary Ellen Kloss, the Tallahassee Bureau Chief for the Miami Herald. Mary Ellen, a special session is set June 1st. Any special rules?
Well, with the special session, they are limited in whatever they have decided the scope of the session will be. So they have not announced what that is. We know it's definitely going to be the budget because they must pass that by June 30th in order for the state to continue running as normal. But we don't know if they will expand that to include other elements. Now, part of the budget, of course, is this health care fight that has stalemated them and led to this early adjournment of the session. But there's many other pieces that could be added as a budget idea. And so it's uncertain now how broad the scope of the special session
does that
will be.
Threaten to muck it up if they're only going to be focused on this $4 billion gulf between what the House wants to spend and what the Senate wants to spend in a $77 billion budget? Perhaps they can bridge that gulf. But if they're putting all $77 billion to the test in 20 days, are they going to be able to get it?
Well, if they start the session with some understanding of agreement on how they're going to reach the end, then that $4 billion is not a very big gap. However, that's the big question is, do they have an agreement when they open the doors on June 1st?
Right.
And I've been rather encouraged talking to a lot of legislators this week. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes conversation going on. There is, I think, a very earnest effort to find a middle ground and propose ideas. Now, I'm not I'm not sure I'm seeing any signals that they're there or that they, but there's optimism.
It's a good sign that the Florida House, which had been resisting the Florida Senate's overtures regarding budget negotiations in the final 3.5 days of the session, agreed essentially to the Senate's schedule for a special session, isn't it?
Right, right. So they have agreed to a schedule, but guess what? That's all they've agreed to.
They haven't agreed to what they're going to do with that schedule, yeah.
That's right.
Do they work weekends, by the way, in this 20? It's a schedule of June 1st through June 20th. Does that include weekends?
Well, it does, because a lot of times what will happen is they have the budget committees will break apart, take testimony on each of their budget silos, and then they'll temporarily adjourn those committees,
right.
And then the leaders will get together. And often that is done, especially in probably the last week, that is they stretch it over the weekend. And, you know, I think they could try and do something like get this done in 2 weeks and make it look better than what they've laid out.
I see.
Okay. There's always that possibility.
Always that possibility. Spoken like a true optimist. Mary Ellen Kloss, right. Covering Tallahassee for the Miami Herald, with us from WFSU in Tallahassee. Join the conversation. What are your expectations for Florida lawmakers as they go back to work in June? What happens to a state agency perhaps that you rely on if there is no state budget? Let us know at 800-743-9576. If you're a Florida Republican, how does this make you feel about your representatives that are in a supermajority in Tallahassee? 1-800-743-9576 on Twitter and Facebook at WLRN. Now, the governor did travel to Washington this week to make an overture to the Health and Human Services Agency, which is to decide how much, if any, federal money for this low-income pool of money is to come to Florida. The Republicans, as you know, Mary Ellen, have said they can't make a budget until they know what the feds are going to spend on this low-income pool. Did the governor get any clarity at all?
Well, I think he did want to get them to promise a date certain when we'd get an answer, but he didn't. And I guess it's no surprise if the federal government was stonewalling him a bit, because he has sued them, and he's sued them twice in the last 2 weeks over this very issue. So that hasn't made their relationship, hasn't softened the relationship any. On the other hand, we are in this extraordinarily unusual place where Florida's budget is dependent on getting word from the federal government as to how much they're going to send us. And, that it could be as little as $300 million. It could be what the state wants, which is exactly what we had the last time around, which is $1.3 billion. And I think it's going to be somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. But that still leaves a giant gap.
A big gap. And left in the lurch, hospitals and those hospital workers that provide this charity care. Frank Denton is joining us now over the telephone. He's the editor at Florida Times Union in Jacksonville. And Frank, we heard from healthcare representatives in North Florida essentially saying their livelihood rests on whether or not they get this federal LIP money, this low-income pool money. Is that going to step up pressure on lawmakers into June?
Well, it should. We've certainly been editorializing on it. It's not just pressure on these people's salary. It's the University of Florida Hospital here, formerly known as Shands, could very well go under. They're saying that by the end of the year, they would have to close the hospital, which is one of the major components of the healthcare system here, and our only level one trauma hospital. So they're talking about things like having to put MASH tents in the parking lots of other hospitals here, including Mayo Clinic, and having to airlift really traumatized patients to Gainesville from a city of 1.3 million people.
Yeah. We have not heard such kind of threats essentially here in South Florida, but that is a significant movement for this major healthcare facility essentially to say without these dollars, it shuts its doors.
Well, you haven't heard that much down there because your hospitals for the poor are not as reliant on state and federal money as UF Shands is. And they had no cash reserves and like 90 days of cash. So if the budget doesn't make them whole, they are looking at losing, suppliers and vendors. And there are 5,500 people who work at that hospital. It's a major medical center. And they are saying, and other hospital leaders here are saying, that it will close by the end of the year. if the state and feds don't work this out.
Frank Denton is the editor at the Florida Times Union newspaper in Jacksonville. Frank, with that kind of threat by a major healthcare facility in Jacksonville, has that been enough to sway Republican lawmakers from North Florida, perhaps, to change positions?
Well, I think they're working on it. We certainly are editorializing on it, and the mayor's been to Tallahassee, and it's a big issue in the mayoral campaign here that's going on right now. But we're not seeing a lot of movement. We have heard the Senate president and the speaker, I believe, maybe the governor, I'm not sure, they're saying and have said publicly that they won't allow any hospitals to close,
right.
But they have not addressed the reality of UF shims.
Frank Denton, editor at the Florida Times Union, Mary Ellen Kloss covering Tallahassee in Tallahassee with the Miami Herald with us here on the Florida Roundup. 1-800-743-9576, 800-743-WLRN on Facebook and on Twitter. Look for us there at WLRN. Mary Ellen, Frank mentions some of the high-level officials involved. You talked about some hallway conversations. The legislature here has a full month of no session to hear from constituents, to hear from business leaders, to hear from local leaders about this health care issue. What does one anticipate them to hear?
Well, you know, I think the pressure will be on if we get closer and closer to session, or if session begins and it looks like we continue to have a stalemate. You know, it doesn't affect people's lives until it's pretty clear that after, you know, we're going to have to see, as Frank mentioned, hospitals starting to think of emergency plans for how they deal with trauma patients, or even state parks threatening to say, we're going to have to close after June 30th because we don't have any money left. And school mm-hmm. districts have to start entering into contracts with teachers, but they don't know how much money they're going to get, so they don't know how many teachers they're going to be able to hire. Those are the practical things that I think, as the month goes on, will start to have an effect on forcing them to come to some solution, even if it's one that nobody likes.
Is there room for compromise here, Frank Denton? We heard some awfully strong rhetoric in late April coming from the Florida House that Medicaid expansion was off the table, not to be considered at all.
Well, the governor's saying that too now. He didn't say that last year. But it, Mary Ellen's in a much better position than I to assess the legislature. We don't. North Florida right now doesn't have any really powerful members of the legislature. We lost Senator Thrasher to Florida State, so I'm not sure how well we're represented there right now. And I hope they're taking this seriously, because we've looked in the eyes of the hospital administrators, all the hospitals, and you know they're saying this would be like a hurricane to hit Jacksonville and Northeast Florida if UF shams close down.
Mary Ellen, how about it? Any room for compromise? When last we left it, the Speaker of the Florida House said Medicaid expansion, absolutely not, never.
Actually, I have spent the week talking to a lot of legislators and leadership, and they are talking, and they're talking pretty often. I have been extraordinarily encouraged by what I'm hearing, in that there is just a lot of kind of creative ideas being thrown out there as potential middle ground. The hard piece is to make sure that the House and Senate, which have both hardened their positions in the end, get to look as though they can save face going forward.
Yeah.
That's going to be the difficulty. But there is a lot of middle ground. I'm actually working on a story that will run this weekend about some of where those ideas are.
Mary Ellen Kloss covering Tallahassee for the Miami Herald. Frank Denton watching all things Tallahassee from Jacksonville. He's editor of the Florida Times Union newspaper. Thanks to both of you for joining us here on the Florida Roundup today. Still to come on our program, dozens of police-involved shooting by the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Department are under scrutiny, and the effort to use police body cameras in South Florida. Many police departments are turning to body cameras to document actions of their officers, and the public for that matter. By the end of this month, 30 Miami Beach police will be wearing body cameras. In its proposed budget for next year, the Broward County Sheriff says the agency is, quote, strongly committed to equipping all of our uniformed deputies with body cameras. Trouble is, the department in Broward County doesn't have the money to pay for them exactly yet. Miami-Dade County Mayor Carlos Jimenez has made no secret for his push for 500 cameras for Miami-Dade County officers. So should South Florida cops have body cameras? Would they answer questions in tough cases? Would they help protect the public, protect police? What about privacy concerns? Police body cameras in South Florida, the topic here on the Florida Roundup, with your input at 800-743-WLRN, 1-800-743-9576. You can also send us a tweet at WLRN or look for us on Facebook, WLRN. So how do these body cameras work? Joining us here is Chuck Rabin, covering cops and crime for a good long time for the Miami Herald. Chuck, good to see you. Welcome back to the Florida Roundup. Hey, let me ask you about how these body cameras that Miami Beach wants to use and is using a test pilot, how do they work?
It's pretty simple. They're about palm-sized devices that go on the uniform, generally, I guess, in the chest area, but they're testing where to go. The officer has a charger. He puts it on. It's actually on full-time, but it doesn't record. What they do is there's a little green button. They push when that lights up. They push it over, and it backtracks for 30 seconds prior to that and records forward from that moment on.
It's kind of like your own personal body TiVo of some kind, right?
Yeah, that's exactly what it's
like.
Yeah,
and this pilot program for Miami Beach is limited to 30 officers. Where are those officers going to be deployed, and what do they hope to see out of this pilot program?
Most of them are traffic cops. They may stretch out to other areas. They haven't really said where yet. The idea is just to see how it works, to see what the problems are with it, to see how the public adjusts to it, to see if the officers adjust to it. They've got the same pilot program going in Miami now, and at least according to their chief, the biggest complaints from the officers have been, you know, technical glitches, the time it takes to upload the stuff and stuff like that.
More like after the fact, after some incident.
Exactly.
Right. How do these replace dashboard cameras that so many officers and so many departments have used over the course of a lot of years?
I don't believe so. I think it's just there's such a cry for these things now. It's the momentum's moving in such a direction, and it's happening to so many police departments around the country. And like you said, the problem is the cost. It's very expensive.
Yeah, very expensive. What's Miami Beach investing in these?
I don't know what the original investment is, but the chief said that it'll come to outfit the entire department. It'd be about $3 million every 5 years.
Every 5 years. The cameras as well as the maintenance and the back office technology involved.
The
here.
Real expense is actually storing
the
video. And the way that works is when a shift is over, the officer goes back, puts it in the charger, and it uploads into the cloud somewhere.
Does it capture audio as well, or is it just
video?
Yeah,
it does. We saw a test of it, and it's as clear as your television in your living room.
And what are they? Are they protecting themselves? Are they protecting the public? For the Miami Beach, and you spoke to the officers and the chief, what specifically are they after, as opposed to broadly this debate about body cameras?
I don't think that it's anything everybody's after. I just think there's such a cry for it around the country that it's coming, and everybody realizes that. So the senior administrators are telling their rank and file that this is something you've got to get used to.
Yeah.
You know, and
it's telling the public too, right?
Absolutely,
yeah,
the public. I mean, we see whether it helps or not. You know, people have their own opinions, but you see what's going on in Baltimore. You saw what happened in Ferguson. You saw what happened in Staten Island.
Right.
What people tend to find, I think, is that it's gonna be for the better, because when a camera's on, people act differently. The officer certainly will act differently as far as dealing with the public. And the public, once they know they're being filmed, are probably going to act differently. So, you know, the fears from the union are the time it takes to turn on the camera, and that could put an officer in danger. Could be a founded fear, but as far as acting responsibly, it really can't hurt.
Chuck Rabin has covered law enforcement and cops for a good long time here in South Florida. He writes and is a reporter for the Miami Herald. We're talking about police body cameras coming to some South Florida police departments here on the Florida Roundup. Join the conversation. Any concerns if you're stopped for a traffic violation that you may be live on camera with the officer? Privacy concerns trumped here by the public safety issues. 1-800-743-9576. 1-800-743-WLRN. on Twitter and on Facebook. Look for us at WLRN. Talking about the privacy concerns here, a number of agencies, a number of privacy advocates have been concerned about innocent parties. A traffic stop may be involved. A police officer may think there's an infraction. There isn't ultimately an infraction, or even is adjudicated and goes through the criminal justice system, and a not guilty verdict is rendered by a jury or by a judge, or the prosecutors decide to drop the case. The video's out there, ultimately. The video is going to be part of the public record.
Yeah, I think what you'll find is that this is going to be a very helpful prosecutorial tool. You're right. It's going to be probably a more important after-the-fact thing. But can it hurt to record things? The biggest problem is privacy issues going into people's homes.
Right,
at least
right.
on the beach, they're going to use them when they go in. People, you know, that when you go into a home, you'll tell people. They're not going to tell everybody every day and every stop that they're wearing them. But if somebody asks, they certainly are going to say, yes, we're wearing a camera.
Yeah, is there a search and seizure question here? There's got to be when you cross over the plane into somebody's private property, but either a business or a home.
Well, the legislature already passed a bill that as far as public records concerns, when they go into someone's house, that's not going to be something for public consumption.
Yeah.
So I guess people can sort of feel better about that. It is a weird thing, you know. You get a computer stolen in your house, you call a police officer and he comes in with a camera staring at your face.
That's right. Yeah, sure. You've covered and talked with a lot of officers, a lot of unions, a lot of different departments through the years, Chuck. You know, we've gone, as technology has entered into law enforcement, dashboard cameras are very common these days. Street level cameras are very common these days. Private security cameras are often used ultimately if there's a crime committed on a street corner and there happens to be a private camera, an ATM camera or whatnot. Is this just part of the natural progression of technology in law enforcement that some officers that may resist this are going to have to accept?
Yeah, I mean, Big Brother's here, right? I mean, but when's the last time that there was an instance of something happening and police and attorneys and everybody else involved didn't go searching for whatever surveillance camera was out there?
Right.
I mean, they're doing it anyway.
And we know that video isn't necessarily the final and last judgment of an incident. We have seen multiple cases where a crime or a supposed crime has been caught on video and the alleged perpetrator has been found ultimately not guilty.
Right. And the video can't, a video camera can't lie on the witness stand, no matter what you
do. That's right. Video, that's very true here. Give us a call here. Your thoughts on body cameras, 800-743-9576, 1-800-743-WLRN. This is the Florida Roundup here on WLRN. Now, no body cameras necessarily in Palm Beach County, but an extensive investigation by the Palm Beach Post and television station WPTV found that over the past 15 years, the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Department has been involved in 45 fatal shootings, 38 shootings wounded somebody. No deputies have faced criminal charges, and a dozen shootings were ruled unjustified. The sheriff in Palm Beach County is Rick Bradshaw.
We don't ask people to fight with us that are armed. We don't ask people to draw guns on us to try to kill us. And if they do, then we're going to take the action that we have to do so they don't shoot and kill us.
Leading up the investigation for the Palm Beach Post is investigative reporter Lawrence Mower. He joins us on the telephone. Lawrence, this investigation series, 15 years worth of police shootings along the Treasure Coast, really focused on Palm Beach County. You found 123 shootings over this 15-year time span. Any common characteristics?
They kind of range they're kind of all over the place, but we did find some trends in the data. We found that, a quarter of people were unarmed, for example. That's a very high statistic compared to other departments. We found that African-Americans are shot at a far disproportionate rate, and they were most likely among the groups to be unarmed. A third of them were unarmed. And we found also that, like you mentioned earlier, that hardly any of these deputies were disciplined, much less charged, even when evidence seemed to go against them.
Yeah, how does the Palm Beach Sheriff's Office shootings that you looked into, how does the Sheriff's Office in Palm Beach compare to other similarly sized departments in terms of these police-involved shootings?
Well, that's one thing that's actually kind of hard to track, because nobody actually tracks the number of shootings by officers anywhere in the country, really. And so we kind of did gather some data on agencies around the state, We found that they were largely, you know, around the same range for other departments their size. But really, we wanted to look at, instead of just the raw numbers, what kinds of shootings are happening, mm-hmm. why are they happening, and what's leading up to them?
Yeah, what conclusions were you able to draw from all of those 123 separate incidents that were involved that you found over 15 years?
Well, the big thing was how they're investigated, okay? So there's different, steps in the investigative process. First, there's a criminal investigation by the department's own homicide detectives. After that, there's a state attorney investigation. And after that, there's an internal investigation. And this is where officers would be disciplined, is in this internal investigation. And the big thing we found is that those investigations were really inadequate. They left out critical information, such as saying whether or not shootings hit innocent bystanders. In some cases, the information in the reports was just wrong. There was a shooting in which a deputy fired at a vehicle, a kid with Down syndrome who was driving a minivan. And the report said that the deputy was standing in front of the minivan, and they reviewed traffic. There's actually a traffic camera footage of it. However, when we looked at the traffic camera video, that's undisputable. The deputy was behind the vehicle when he started shooting. The vehicle was fleeing him at the time he shot, and that's a big difference there.
A significant difference. And what was the conclusion?
The conclusion was justified by both the state attorney's office, who also said that the vehicle, or that he was in front of the vehicle when he fired, and justified internally within the department.
And is there any route for appeal for those rulings of justified police-involved shooting?
No, there's really not. The only option is to file potentially a lawsuit against the department.
A civil lawsuit.
A civil lawsuit, exactly. That doesn't happen very often. But it does happen in some of these controversial shootings.
And this week we learned that the FBI has launched an investigation into a single police-involved shooting involving the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office. Do we know what case?
We don't know exactly. The FBI is not saying for sure, and neither is PBSO. What I'm kind of hearing is that is probably a shooting in 2013 involving a kid who, he was an adult, but a young man with a cell phone who had just gotten off a bicycle. It's probably that case.
This is the case of Dontrell Stevens. Tell us about Mr. Stevens.
Stevens was driving or riding a bicycle, and he, according to the deputy, he crossed a major street, and it caused another car to slow down. Okay, and so the deputy decided to pursue him. The deputy also said that this guy, Dontrell Stevens, did not look familiar. Most of this incident is captured on video. And what it shows is that...
Dashboard camera video, we should add, right, Lawrence? Dashboard
exactly.
camera. Right.
It's the dashboard camera. And it shows that the deputy pulls him over. He gets off his bicycle and kind of walks in between two cars. It doesn't look like an abnormal thing he does. You can see in his hand on the video that he has a cell phone, a black cell phone in his right hand. And 4 seconds after the deputy gets out of the car, the deputy shoots him multiple times. I think it was 3 or 4 times. And he's paralyzed for life. Now, the shooting itself was not captured on video. Both Dontrell Stevens and the deputy are just off camera, but you see him falling and getting shot. He comes back into the frame when that happens, and it's pretty shocking, but it's only 4 seconds afterward. And what the deputy said is that Dontrell Stevens kind of turned his body towards him, or turned his body to make himself look narrower, like he was about to draw a weapon. And basically, the deputy perceived the cell phone to be a handgun.
And the findings into that shooting, have they been concluded?
Yes, it was ruled justified. Obviously the video wasn't made public until we brought it out, and it's gotten a lot of attention since. It's made national news and gotten quite a bit of attention.
Lawrence Mower is an investigative reporter with the Palm Beach Post. Chuck Rabin is still with us covering crime in Miami-Dade County and elsewhere here in South Florida. Let's go to your phone calls. Glenn joining us from Wellington. Glenn, go ahead.
Hi there. I live in Wellington. I'm all for. I'm 100% for the cameras for two particular reasons. For corruption and for complacency. Corruption, in most particularly around the those who have power. Power ultimately corrupts over time. And for those who don't let corruption get to them, complacency. We're all human. We all let the rules of the job lax every once in a while. Everyone's guilty of it, whether or not they admit it.
Gotcha. Your second reason why you like them.
The complacency issue. Like I said, we're all human. We all make mistakes. Even on the job, we let the rules of the job sometimes lax.
especially when nobody is looking, and there's the key.
Gotcha. The now, corruption and complacency. Glenn in Wellington voicing support for more police body cameras. Let's go to Justin in North Miami Beach. Justin, go ahead. Welcome to the program.
Good afternoon. I feel that I also have two reasons. One is accountability, to hold the public accountable and also hold officers accountable. But I think even more so, you see a lot of these videos that people take, and it's about from like 10, 15 feet away. I think it really helped to see from the officer's point of view, because when you're about 5 feet away from somebody, you can't really see all the details, and the whole situation could be seen differently when you're actually in there. So I think it will actually, I guess, humanize the officers and see that, yes, they are trained, but, when you're that close, things may not appear what they really are.
Justin, why do you think that's important for body cameras in this case?
I feel it's important because, we have all these other cameras that they say, from 10 feet away, you can see that the guy wasn't armed or you can see that he wasn't doing anything. But, I'm a bachelor's in criminal justice. My dad's a police officer, but I'm also from inner city New York. When you're within that, when you're within 5 feet of somebody and they're moving very quickly or whatnot, that camera could show you how the officer was actually seeing that. Because from 5 feet away, 10 feet away, on a regular camera, you see the whole situation.
Justin, we appreciate your father's service and your phone call here today, Justin, from North Miami Beach. Lawrence Mower, final question here. Any kind of conversation that your investigative series has sparked with the Palm Beach County Sheriff's Office and potential body cameras?
No, they're finding down in Miami, it's very expensive to roll these things out. And the sheriff has said, well, it's not going to capture everything that happens. I think the sheriff had given some kind of estimate of like 15 to 18 million, I think, to roll these out for his patrol deputies. So that's not something that's on the table at the moment, he says, but we'll see.
Chuck Rabin, Miami Beach is known for some happenings around Memorial Day. That is in the month of May. That is during this testing period that Miami Beach police officers, 30 of them, will have these body cameras. What do we expect to see perhaps in early June?
I think what you're going to see and what you're going to learn is that it's really, a couple of things. The fellows worry about corruption and all that stuff. You got to remember, the cameras only go on when the officer turns the button on.
Yeah.
So it's not like he's going to be sitting in some smoke-filled back room with, some guy from some local business. Although I guess he would have to turn it on at that point. But I think it's going to, most things are captured on video nowadays anyway. Memorial Day, they had a terrible time in 2011 with the Raymond Heresy situation. They've sort of figured out how to deal with the public a lot better. You'll see a bunch of rowdy people and you'll see the police interacting. I don't see it making a gigantic difference. If anything, more times than not, you're probably going to see that an officer was acting correctly in what he was doing.
Chuck Rabin, covering law enforcement for the Miami Herald. Lawrence Mower, investigative reporter with the Palm Beach Post, writing about police-involved shootings along the Treasure Coast. Thanks to both of you for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Still to come on the program, how to be a Cuban and immigrant to the United States without being from Cuba. Like millions of Cubans, Victor Arrieta came to the United States and was able to stay thanks to the special immigration status of Cubans. Now, the only difference was that he was not born in Cuba.
I usually consider myself Brazilian. I was born in Brazil. When I moved here, it wasn't for political reasons. It was because my family lived here. And it wasn't for economic reasons either. I benefited from the Cuban Adjustment Act.
That law, the Cuban Adjustment Act, traces back to 1966, allowing Cubans who make it to the U.S. to become permanent residents after 1 year. It's a lot faster than immigrants from other countries. And you don't have to be born in Cuba to qualify. The Sun Sentinel has been investigating how the Cuban Adjustment Act is being used. Our guest leading up that investigation, Sally Keston with the Sun Sentinel, and John Maines. Our America's editor, Tim Padgett, here at WLRN, also joining us. Sally, wildly interesting loophole here, essentially, that you have uncovered and dozens of other folks have found. What is this interpretation? What is this loophole?
Well, it's actually written into the law. The law says, defines a Cuban as a native or citizen of Cuba. And immigration rulings here have defined that as anyone born to a Cuban parent anywhere. So you can be born in Brazil like Victor Arrieta, or born really anywhere in any country, and as long as your mother or father was born in Cuba, you qualify as a Cuban citizen under our law.
So this traces back, I guess, one generation at least, if one parent can claim Cuban birth, Cuban citizenry, you qualify as a Cuban under this U.S. immigrant law.
That's right. And we even found one case where someone was admitted under this law who just had a grandparent with Cuban heritage, although that's rare. But yes, it's anybody with a Cuban parent.
John Maines with the Sun Sentinel. How many folks do you think have taken advantage of this interpretation?
Well, the Customs gave us a definite number of 1,074 going to 2008. And but they said if you took the entire duration of the act, it'd be thousands.
Yeah, they're going back to 1966,
right.
For instance. Yeah.
Right.
Have you been able to see if there's been an increase in the volume of these one generation removed from Cuba entrants into the Cuban Adjustment Act?
Actually, it appeared that we only got kind of a straight number. It appeared that it was actually going down a little bit, but and we don't know why that, what would cause that in the short time frame that we had for 2008. But they were coming from all around the world. I mean, it was like a quarter of them were from Venezuela, which one could argue that's no paradise and you'd want to get out of there. But you know, it was Angola, Mexico, Costa Rica, and some places that are pretty nice to live, like France and Germany.
Sure, but they've been able to take advantage of this. And Tim Padgett, the main advantage of this Cuban Adjustment Act is that 1 year becoming a permanent resident, is it not?
Oh, sure. I mean, anyone, whether you're Cuban or not, would want to take advantage of that. And this was a very savvy strategy, really, on the part of the Cuban-American leadership here in this country, because, you know, it was just a way to, accumulate a larger let's cut to the chase.
Sure.
Voter force.
Sure, sure.
Here, but it can backfire on them politically through stories like this that are running in the Sun Sentinel, because it's just another thing that tends to alienate the rest of the Latino community in this country.
Sally Kasten with the Sun Sentinel. To that end, it sounds as if a portion of the Cuban Adjustment Act essentially outsources the policymaking to a Cuba definition, to a definition that is defined by the Cuban government, not by the U.S. government.
That's right. That's what U.S. immigration authorities rely on, is the Cuba definition of a citizen. But that's not unusual. We turn to other countries and use their definition of citizenship in immigration cases. So that part's not unusual. And actually, Cuba's definition of a citizen is pretty consistent with other countries. What's unusual here is the huge advantage that it gives to people who are born in other countries to claim Cuban citizenship. You jump to the front of the immigration line and you shave off years of waiting to get into this country.
John Maines, were you able to discern specific volumes of immigrants using this interpretation from various places? You talked about some folks from France coming, in Venezuela and Brazil and Costa Rica, but were you able to find any real pockets?
The real pockets are pretty much where I mentioned. Of course, Russia was common because Russia had a good relationship with Cuba for
sure,
so long.
With the Soviet Union,
Soviet Union, Ukraine, that area. So you know, Eastern Europe would be one place. But you know, once you got out of Venezuela and some of the other, Bolivia was high. It was pretty much a mix.
And Tom, we should point out that Venezuela was a source of this long before Hugo Chavez and the Socialist Revolution came to power there. My wife's from Venezuela, and she was, you know, familiar with many, many people who had come, you know, exiles who had come to Venezuela rather than the United States, and their children then became, you know, eligible for this sort of thing.
Yeah, is this something that is, I suppose, well known within the Cuban community, the expat community outside of Cuba, outside of the United States?
Oh yeah, yeah. You take go into countries like Venezuela, and they'll say, you know, going back to the 60s and 70s, this was a phenomenon.
We call it a loophole, but it's perfectly legal.
Yes.
The reaction has been what, Sally?
You know, we reached out to members of Congress from South Florida, and they all categorize it as an abuse of or exploitation of the law. It's certainly not what was intended when it was passed way back in 1966, that it would extend out to people who, you know, were not only not born in Cuba, but in many cases had never even been to Cuba.
Did that kind of ring a little hollow, though? I mean, this is, you know, this goes back to 1966. This wasn't passed in 2006. So we've seen generations, presumably, to be able to take advantage of this. For a current legislator to say, well, that wasn't the intent of the 1966 law, seems to be either a misreading of how it's been used for the past half century, isn't it?
Yeah, I think you have to look at this in the political context, and that is, you know, there really isn't a political will to change this law, particularly by Cuban Americans in Congress. It just doesn't benefit them with their constituents, with their voters. So they'll, you know, they'll say, they have to almost say, well, this isn't what was intended, it's an abuse. But what they're going to do about it, you know, not really clear.
Well, let's talk about that here, because since December 17th, a lot in the relationship between the United States and Cuba has changed, and it's changed very fast as the Obama administration has moved toward renormalizing diplomatic relations. Immigration is not on the bullet point list of things that the administrative's efforts have really focused on yet, Tim, but we know it's out there. We know at some point it's going to be tackled.
Well, and as I said before, that's why I was making the point before, that politically this could backfire on groups like the Cuban American leadership, because, as I said, it alienates the rest of the Latino community, particularly Mexicans, who make up 2/3 of Hispanics in this country. It gives them another reason to resent the privileges that Cuban Americans get in that context. And that is not going to be helpful to candidates like Marco Rubio.
Yeah. Sally, you've with the Sun Sentinel done an investigative series as well, finding how criminals have been able to use the Cuba Readjustment Act. As you've looked at this piece of legislation and its impact on immigration and elsewhere, what kind of conclusions have you been able to draw?
Well, it seems like it is far astray from what was originally envisioned when this was passed, and that was provide a refuge for Cubans who were really fleeing and had no choice and left and came over with nothing, and, you know, for the United States to welcome them and help them rebuild and start a new life here. And it's just not being used that way anymore at all. And I think, you know, we've sort of illustrated the extremes of this: criminals taking advantage of it, going back and forth, taking money they've stolen here to Cuba, hiding out as fugitives. Now this piece of it with people not even born in Cuba being able to take advantage of it. It does seem like it is ripe for a reexamination and really a question of, is it even necessary at all anymore?
John Maines, I mean, what does the data show in terms of the usage of this act? Is it still being exercised as often as it once was?
Oh, yeah. It's, you know, we have anywhere from 20 to 40,000 Cubans coming in per year, and you know, some of them legally, some of them undocumented. They land on a boat. It's still going on strong. And, you know, we heard when people in this winter, we heard that people thought that you know, these relationships are going to be reestablished between the United States and Cuba. The Coast Guard apparently was picking up a lot more people on boats because they were saying, we got to get out of here now. For whatever reason.
Tim Padgett, we still, you know, see stories monthly about rafts and small boats being found or washing ashore.
No,
here in South
John's,
Florida.
John's completely right. Yeah. I mean, as soon as Obama announced that they were going to reestablish diplomatic ties with Cuba, a lot of Cubans panicked because they thought wet foot, dry foot, for example, was going to be eliminated. And so a lot of them got on rafts to get in under what they thought was the wire.
Yeah. Do we know, is there a discussion even on the sidelines of these efforts to normalize relations, Tim, about the Cuban Readjustment Act? Is this on the agenda of the diplomatic negotiators as they talk about the diplomats being housed there, the ability to bank in Cuba, the ability to the free movement around Havana, those kinds of things?
Immigration is definitely one of the issues.
Human rights as well. Yeah.
Human rights. Immigration is definitely one of the issues they're discussing. The U.S. wants to discuss it because they don't want this surge of Cubans coming in. Cubans want you know, things to change in that vein because you know, they're tired of seeing this whole rafters phenomenon themselves.
Let's go to the phones here. Janet is joining the Florida Roundup from Miami. Go ahead, Janet. Welcome.
Yes, I'm glad you guys are bringing this up because everything since the Cuban relation U.S. started again that's one of the biggest questions that we and our family and among friends and everything else we have discussed. Why don't they examine the Cuban Adjustment Act? Why are they not deporting the thousands of people that are here in jail that if they were from a different nationality would have been deported to their countries? What about those people?
Janet, are you talking specifically about Cubans who are in American jails?
Cubans, yes.
Cubans who have been charged with crimes in the United States. Are they eligible for deportation?
No, not at this time. And we found, I believe it's more than 35,000 people, Cubans, who have been ordered deported, who are still here. And that's because Cuba refuses to take them back. It's one of the things that should be on the agenda as they talk about normalizing relations, but have not seen that issue come up yet.
But this goes to show us, Tim, I think that an immigration policy obviously takes two parties, two countries involved here. And with a Cuban who's in America, in an American jail, convicted of a crime or pled guilty, not eligible for deportation because his or her home country won't take them back.
Right. As soon as you normalize the relations, all of this legal infrastructure begins to come into place, not least of which would be things like extradition treaties, for example, that would help facilitate exactly, you know, what Sally was just talking about.
One of the other questions regarding Cuba and its reaction to normalization, of course, came this week with the Treasury Department announcing licenses for ferry service between the U.S. and Cuba. Operators still need the okay, though, from Cuban regulators. Tim, is there going to be this this large call for ferry travel between Florida through the Florida Straits to Cuba? Is there a big demand here?
I think so, because one of the complaints, look, people love, particularly Cuban American families, they love the fact that they can take flights to Cuba, but there's a lot of a red tape, et cetera, that goes with getting on these flights sometimes, and I think a lot of them will want to try the ferry service.
The travel restrictions still apply here. You still have to qualify for one of those 12 categories, but it's self-policing here.
Sure, but I also think that people are going to look at ferry service as perhaps a little easier to do than air travel, and plus, I think they're also going to look at the ferry service as a way to get cargo. Things like, yeah. Clothes and food and capital goods for their cousin who owns a business in Cuba. They're going to look at the ferry services, perhaps, an easier and cheaper way to get that kind of stuff into Cuba.
Than putting it in the overhead bin, as the case may be. Tim Padgett covers the Americas for us here at WLRN. Sally Keston, an investigative reporter with the South Florida Sun-Sentinel, and John Maines with the South Florida Sun-Sentinel as well. Thanks to both of you, all three of you, for joining us here on the Florida Roundup. Rounding up the week, this is what South Florida sounded like with John O'Connor.
It's Friday, and this is what South Florida sounded like this week.
Miami's in its teenage years, and we're trying to figure out if we're going to be Britney Spears or Emma Watson.
They get taken to jail. They panic. Maybe they throw feces at an officer.
Because our paychecks cannot cover everything. Most of us at the airport ended up working two or three jobs.
Folks come down to interview, and then they look at the housing, and they can't take the job for what we're paying because they just can't afford to live here.
I learned how to use a table saw. When I first used it, I pinched the wood, and the wood flew back and hit me in the leg.
So we had to bust it in three languages. It was crazy.
It's like onion?
Yes, it's garlic chives.
Oh, yeah.
Want to try one?
To hear more, go to WLRN.org/thisweek.
And finally on the roundup, we have to say goodbye to one of the folks that makes this program possible each week here on WLRN, Steph Farrow. I have to tell you that Steph is a woman who wears a lot of hats. She's been responsible for our public insight network that we share with the Miami Herald. If you're one of the more than 16,000 members, odds are pretty good that you've gotten an email from Steph asking more about your input for stories you hear on the radio, WLRN, and inside the Miami Herald. If there's a story that stuck with you because of the voices in the community you heard, Steph was probably involved. She's been tireless in finding those impacted most by news. She helps draw the line between political policy debates and people affected by it. From poetry to trivia nights, Steph has never met a challenge she couldn't conquer with her wits, her intelligence, and her good humor. You know, the media world is changing fast and evolving in ways tomorrow that we can't even imagine today. But I know that whatever the future may bring for this industry and for you, Steph, that the future is bright and the news business is better off with you in it. Please stay in it. All of us are reflections of our times, and Steph certainly is. She's a writer of memes, a creator of GIFs, and a hero helping the world prepare for zombies by exercising. So best of luck in all that you make with it, Steph, and don't let the zombies catch up.
Run a five, get going.
And that'll do it for the Florida Roundup on this Friday. The program's produced by Alicia Zuckerman, Julia Duba, and the aforementioned zombie runner, Steph Farrow.
Zombies attacked a nearby farmhouse. The survivors are on the roof. We can't just leave them there to die.
Our news director is Terrence Shepard. Our digital editor is Maria Muriel. Program director for WLRN is Peter J. Maris. Our technical supervisor for the program, Lorenzo Ponce de Leon. Thanks, Lorenzo. South Florida Artsbeat is next. Ed Bell will be along in just a couple of moments. Stick around. We'll be back Monday morning at 9 for the Sunshine Economy, taking flight. Aviation in South Florida.
You lost them. Come on home, runner five. We're one step closer to saving the world.
I'm Tom Hudson. Don't let the zombies get you. Thanks for listening.